So I think about my aspiration for the weekend. I think in our culture, we're often taught to think a lot, and we're very good at it. It's one of our primary areas of expertise is thinking. We don't always know how to think well. We're not always taught what it is to reflect, to be able to hold a question in a climate of inner stillness, with an openness to understanding how those questions land in our own hearts, our minds, our lives. So my hope over this weekend is that we find this balance, these times that are really dedicated to cultivating inner stillness, that allow our minds, our hearts to settle, because we cultivate inwardly a climate that is inclined towards insight, a climate of heart and mind that is inclined towards understanding. So in order to really support that, really, our very first step of the day is to have a moment of reflection on perhaps what it is for you to disentangle from the world sufficiently to be here as fully as you're able to be. I know what people's lives often look like. You know, the busyness, the demands, the preoccupations, the expectations. And taking that step to just allow that, you know, to sit in the background is not so easy for many people. And of course, in any kind of retreat, people do find that their lives and follow them onto the cushion, and their lives follow them into the walking path. And, you know, realistically, why would they not? But how we relate to that here is actually the question for us. You know, when our lives follow us into our cushions and our walking space, we so easily get moved into problem solving, you know, rehearsing, anticipating. And disentangling is not a suggestion to push our lives away, or even to push those thoughts away, but to recognize what it is for us to create dedicated spaces in our lives, to let those thoughts just sit in the background of our attention, you know, to feel their magnetic pull, and actually to really know what it means to renew that intentionality, to be here, to simplify, to calm, to settle in this moment. Now, I find in teaching in the West over many years that there's often been something of an artificial division made between what we call meditation and what we call contemplation or reflection. And I think this is a very understandable division. You know, I'm very aware as, you know, one of the generation of teachers, you know, very involved in creating retreat centers and spaces for silent meditation, that we've almost kind of set the example that meditation is the real thing. You know, sit with your eyes closed, you know, find a cushion, you know, stop thinking. I think people even hear that message, stop thinking. You know, calm yourself down, and feel. But yet the outcome of that, I feel, is often for many people to have this sense of division between their meditation practice and their life. And I think there's another complicating factor in that, is I think that in, you know, Western culture and the emphasis upon education and becoming and striving, that sometimes people feel a little bit weary of the life of their mind, understandably. And sometimes reflection is referred to as the intellectual stuff. You know, the intellectual stuff, but not really the practice. In fact, I've heard this said many times, you know, time to put the intellectual stuff down and do the real thing, you know, which is to sit with my eyes closed and breathe and pretend life is not going on. It's interesting, you know, I remember a story from Ajahn Chah's monastery. You know, it was a fervent young Western monk, you know, going to Ajahn Chah and complaining that they had so many tasks to do in the day, that they didn't have enough time to sit, and surely he wasn't going to get enlightened unless he had more time to sit, you know. And Ajahn Chah looking at him in this bemused way and saying, you know, I've seen a lot of chickens really good at sitting and never met an enlightened chicken. And so I think it's very important to dissolve this separation between reflection and more formal cultivation and meditation. My own sense is that, you know, the Dharma really tends to merge these two in a very skillful way. They're interwoven, very much part of the path of awakening. In fact, the Buddha very much proposed this, talking about the steps of insight. And he said the first step of insight is to listen to the teaching. To listen to the teachings. Not to adopt them blindly, but to listen. And he said the second step of insight is to take those teachings and to examine them in the light of our own experience. Is this true? How does this apply to me? Is this something that makes sense, you know, conceptually and experientially? And he said the third step of insight is actually the embodiment of those teachings that we understand to be true and valuable, to embody them in all of our lives. Now, when I reflect on these steps of insight, you know, I'm very aware of really kind of what gets in the way of those steps. It's not easy to listen, because our listening is competing often with the waterfall of our own preoccupations and obsessions and repetitive thinking. Isn't that true? You know, we're filtering often what we hear through some of that tsunami of busyness. It's not easy to really examine the teachings in the light of our own experience, because, you know, that takes commitment, it takes dedication, it takes some stillness. And as many people describe their lives, they have so much to do. You know, they have so much to do, that there is so much busyness. And my own sense is that embodiment is probably the greatest challenge for us all, that we can sense too often these very uncomfortable gaps between what we value and aspire to and how we live our lives. And that's basically going to be the sort of reflection of the weekend. So I hope you're prepared to be a little bit uncomfortable, because I think the question of embodiment and gaps is a very challenging question for us. And it requires us to have the willingness to be slightly uncomfortable and to know that discomfort is not always a negative thing. When you read the teachings of the Buddha, what you see so clearly is that the teachings are, in a very real way, a reflection of every human heart and the longings of every human heart. The longings to be loved, to be respected, to be accepted, the longings to be free from pain, to be free from conflict and loneliness, the longings to have a heart and a mind that genuinely feel to be a friend and a refuge to us. The longings of every human heart to have a life that feels meaningful and worthy. Now, I think in human beings, generally, we're quite reticent and we're quite shy about articulating these longings And, you know, I do see, as many people in this culture, in practice, that, you know, the sense of deflated expectation tends to stand out. You know, so it's very difficult often to even give language to those deepest longings. And I think the great value of the teaching and the great value of the Dharma is that it's not bothered with shyness or reticence. That it's very much, but gives language to and very much honors those longings to live a noble life and to find a noble way of being in this world. And it's very much proposed in the Buddhist teaching that the seeds of very profound compassion, profound wakefulness, profound kindness, that these seeds live in every human heart. That our minds, our hearts, are not predetermined, they're not static, they're not fixed, but that every heart, mind, lives in a state of potentiality, being shaped moment to moment by a range of different factors. And we see this in our own experience, don't we? That sometimes our mind, heart, can be shaped by fear, by anger, by contractedness, by depression, by beliefs in insufficiency. And often when our mind, heart is shaped in that way, we do sometimes do feel a sense of disappointment in ourselves. That somehow how we are being, what we are experiencing, is somehow not quite what we would aspire to or really value. Other times we have a very different experience, and we see that the way our mind and heart is shaped by calm, by spaciousness, by peace, by compassion, by understanding. And these are the moments when we really feel to be most deeply aligned with our deepest values, our deepest aspirations. So the path of the Dharma, this teaching, really suggests, of course, that we are not at all helpless, that we can be a very conscious participant in the quality with which we live our lives, that we very much can be a conscious participant in how our minds, hearts are shaped moment to moment, that we have the capacity to cultivate the ennobling, the wakeful, what is dignifying, and to live our lives in the light of those understandings. The Buddha put forward a very simple formula that what our minds incline towards, this we will become. That what our minds incline towards, this we will become. What we frequently think and dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind, and that the shape of our mind becomes the shape of our life. Now, to me, that's a very hopeful proposal, because we actually see there is nothing predetermined about the way that our minds and hearts inclined. And just because various patterns that we experience repeatedly, that just because they have a long history, does not suggest that they have an equally long future. And that this is all very much related to what we are cultivating, what we are inclining our hearts and minds towards in this moment. So there are some very timeless dilemmas, I think timeless questions in every human life, and I think they're very worthy dilemmas and very worthy questions. How to be at peace with ourselves, to have relationships marked by respect, by understanding, by kindness. How to heal pain, not only inwardly, but the vast amounts of pain in our world. How to embrace loss, mortality, change with grace and fearlessness. how to live in a world that is scarred by so much conflict and separation and division and fear without being a participant in those states. Now, when you look back over the history of the Buddha's path, and it's really not a Buddhist thing at all, when you look back over the history of every great spiritual tradition, it's almost like two pathways open up before us when we're faced with that which seems so difficult to be with. When we're faced with our mortality, when we're faced with conflict, when we're faced with seemingly irreconcilable differences and separations, it's almost like there are two pathways that open up. And both of these pathways have long histories. And I think every spiritual tradition I know of, and I certainly see this in the history of early Buddhism, that one pathway that opens up is the path of transcendence. How do I get out of this? You know, how do I find somewhere else to be? How do I separate? How do I, you know, create a distance? How do I transcend all of this? You know, this conviction that the fulfillment of our aspirations, the great peace, the great compassion, the great wakefulness, that it lies somewhere else, that it lies in some other place and not where we are. And then treating where we are basically as a problem and as an obstacle and something to get out of. And this was, of course, the context that the Buddha began practicing in, and very understandable context. I think when life feels so difficult, and I'm pretty sure life felt pretty difficult in India 2,600 years ago, it's very easy to regard it as a problem. It's very easy to regard our relationships as a problem, you know, our work as a problem, the demands in our life as a problem. And of course, traditionally in those times, you know, the way to get out was basically through mortifying the body, through trying to subdue the mind, through concentration practices, through separating from the world. And I really understand that. I can understand that first sense. But of course, you know, we do this conventionally too, you know, in our world. How do I get out? How do I numb my mind? You know, how do I use alcohol or drugs to find that sense of disconnection that feels safer? You know, how do I separate? But it, in most people's experience, this doesn't actually work very well. You know, I mean, I think all of us, you know, we might have dreams about retiring to a cave, but believe me, your mind's going with you, you know, and you will probably sit in your cave arguing with the bats, you know, and, you know, with the temperature and, you know, with the hardness of your cushion, you know, the arguments will go with you. And the Buddha certainly didn't disdain the idea of transcendence. But he didn't. His genius was to sometimes take some of these contexts and almost change them so radically to look like something different. So the Buddha did talk about transcendence, but he didn't talk about transcendence of life. He talked about transcendence of suffering and the causes of suffering through understanding. He talked about the transcendence of struggle and alienation and conflict, but through understanding, garnered very much in the classroom of our lives. So transcendence has been one traditional response to conflict and distress. And the other response, I think, which maybe we don't register so well, has really been about the pathway of embodiment. How to live our lives in an embodied way, in the light of our understandings, in the light of our aspirations, in the light of our values, how to embody what we really hold to be precious and dear and and worthy, and how to have those really translated in our actions, in our speech, in our thoughts, and all the ways that we engage with the world. I think this is actually really a big ask, and I'm sure most of you would agree. It's at times it seems impossible, but then I think we really need to remember that the size of the task is only ever equal to the size of the moment. So over this weekend, really, because this is something I've been reflecting on for a couple of years now, and so over the weekend, what I'd like to do is to share with you some of my own reflections about embodiment, and to have you hold those questions in your own mind, what embodiment really means to you, what it looks like to you, what would be asked of you to relinquish in order to bring about that sense of living an ennobled life. And it's almost asking that question that, you know, it comes from Nagarjuna. He asks the question of, what do you do with a life that doesn't go away? There are a lot of things that don't go away in this life, aren't there? Mortality, illnesses, aging, difficult people, our own minds and hearts, the world as it is with its seemingly insolvable issues. There's a lot of things that don't go away. And how do we, what is our relationship to that life that doesn't go away? And it seems to me, and I think this is very much suggested in the Buddha's teaching, you know, one choice is to turn away from that life, you know, to do all that we can to distance ourselves from it, to engage in endless strategizing, to feel undisturbed. And of course, what the Buddha suggested, and this is really the heart of the path of awakening that he presented, is that we learn to turn towards this life. We learn to understand it. We learn to make peace within it. And we learn to live an ennobled and a dignified life within the midst of all things.